So to start, put your attention on the breath for just a moment. Now let go of the breath and shift your attention to the top of the head, to an area about the size of a large coin, and see if you can find any sensation there. Now slowly move your attention back along the center line of the top of the head to the back of the head where the hair grows in a circle, noticing whatever sensation you can notice until you get back to the back of the head. And again, at that spot, see if you can notice any sensation. Now examine the right side of the head from the center line down to the hairline, from the front to the back, just looking for whatever sensation there is, tingling, itching, coolness, hot. Notice the sensation. Move on. If there's no sensation, move on. Now examine the left side of the head from the center line down to the hairline, from the back to the front, looking to see what you can sense. Put your attention on your forehead and examine it from the hairline to the eyebrows, just noticing whatever there is to notice. Put your attention on the right temple and see if you can notice anything there. Examine the right eye. the eyeball, the socket, the eyelid. Move your attention across the bridge of the nose to the left eye and examine it. And then move your attention to the left temple. Examine your left cheek. Just noticing anything that you can notice. The coolness of the air, tingling, tightness, whatever there is. Move your attention to your nose. You probably will be able to feel the breath coming in and out. You might notice other things as well. On to the right cheek. Examine the right ear, the back, the front. All the little folds, as deep inside as you can sense anything, and see if you can pick up any sensations. And now examine the left ear in the same way. Put your attention on your lips. You probably can notice them touching each other. You may notice other sensations as well. Then move inside your mouth and examine whatever you can find. You'll probably notice the saliva, your tongue touching your teeth, perhaps your lips touching your teeth, gums. Just examine the entire inside of your mouth, looking for whatever sensation there is. Move your attention to your chin, and then to your jaw. If you notice your jaw is tight, you can relax it. But you're looking to see just what there is to see. And examine the front of your neck, all the way down to the top of the breastbone. Put your attention on your right shoulder and examine it from the neck out to the shoulder joint. Just sensing anything that can be sensed, perhaps a touch of your clothing, itching, tingling, warmth, coolness. Then move from the shoulder joint down the upper arm to the elbow, looking for sensations. When you reach the right elbow, examine it, and then move down the lower part of the right arm until you reach the wrist. Once you reach the right wrist, examine it, and then move to the back of the hand. You're just looking for sensations. You may be able to feel your hand touching part of your body, coolness against it, Then examine the palm of the right hand. Then, starting with the little finger, examine each finger in turn from the base to the tip and moving around to the thumb. If your hands are touching anything, you'll probably be able to notice at least touch sensation. Put your attention in the tips of the fingers of the right hand, and then sweep your attention out into the room, and then let your attention rest on your left shoulder. And examine your left shoulder from the neck to the shoulder joint, looking for any sensation that you can feel. Then move from the left shoulder down the upper part of the left arm to the elbow. See if you can notice any sensations, tingling, tightness, itching, warmth, cold. Notice what there is to notice and move on. When you reach the left elbow, examine it, and then move down the lower part of the left arm to the wrist. When you reach your left wrist, examine it. If you're wearing a watch, you may be able to notice the touch of the watch. Examine the back of the left hand. and the palm of the left hand. Starting from the little finger on the left hand, examine each of your fingers from the base to the tip, seeing what you can see, and then moving on to the next finger and around to the thumb. When you're finished with the fingers, put your attention in the tips of the fingers and sweep your attention out into the room, and then bring it to rest on the right shoulder. Now examine the right half of the chest from the shoulder down to the bottom of the rib cage, looking for any sensation you can find. You might notice your breathing, the touch of your clothes, itching, tingling, emotions may come up. Just look to see what there is and move on. Now examine the left half of your chest from the shoulder down to the bottom of the rib cage. Put your attention on your right shoulder and then examine the right half of your back from the shoulder down to your waist. put your attention on your left shoulder and examine the left half of your back from the shoulder down to the waist. Just noticing what there is to notice. Put your attention at the base of the skull, which is the top of the spine, and then bring your attention down the spine, vertebrae by vertebrae, all the way to the tailbone, noticing whatever there is to notice. Move your attention to the waist in the back, and then move around the waist to the front, looking for sensations. The touch of your clothes, tightness, tingling, itching, whatever there is, notice it and move on. Bring your attention up into the pit of the stomach, the solar plexus. And then move your attention over the belly and down to the groin. Put your attention in your right buttock. Notice the pressure of sitting. Notice any other sensation that you can notice. And then starting at the right hip, move your attention down the right thigh, looking for anything that you can sense. When you reach the right knee, examine it. Maybe there's pain, maybe there's pleasure, maybe there's just a sense of touch. See what there is to see. And after you finish examining your right knee, move your attention down the lower part of the right leg until you come to the ankle. Examine the right ankle, and after you finish it, examine the top of the right foot. Put your attention in the tendon at the back of the ankle and move down to the heel, and then examine the bottom of the right foot. Starting with the little toe, examine each one of your toes from the base to the tip and moving around to the big toe. When you finish with your toes, put your attention at the tips of the toes of the right foot. Sweep your attention out into the room, and then bring it back to the left buttock and examine it. Notice the pressure of sitting. Notice anything else that you can see. Then move from the left hip down the left thigh to the knee, looking for any sensation. Notice it and move on. Examine the left knee. And then move from the left knee down the lower part of the left leg to the ankle. Examine the left ankle. and then the top of the left foot. Put your attention in the tendon at the back of the left ankle and move down to the heel and along the bottom of the left foot. Starting with the left little toe, examine each of the toes in turn from the base to the tip and moving around to the big toe. Put your attention in the tips of the toes of the left foot and then sweep your attention out into the room and bring your attention to rest on the breath. And you can smile. So, I can answer all these questions, but we have to not eat lunch. But I'll see what I can do.
Okay. What's the difference between Buddha and Jesus?
What's the difference between Buddha and Jesus? We don't need any more questions. This will take us through lunch here. Both were to some extent reformers of the dominant religious paradigm that they lived in. The Buddha lived in a time when Brahmanism was flourishing, and I think all of you know about the time when Jesus was living. Neither set out to found a new religion. However, both of them seem to have spoken the truth and managed to gather enough people around them so that their message has endured to today. The Buddha's primary message is, he said, "I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and its end." Okay, he was just concerned about people being able to get out of their misery. Jesus's primary message, I think, can be best summed up. He was asked, "What is the greatest commandment?" "Love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, mind, soul, and strength. And the second is like unto it. Love thy neighbor as thyself." In other words, Jesus' message was primarily about love. Jesus did talk about suffering. After all, he was Jewish. The Buddha talked about love. I think in a few words, perhaps that's enough to say. How is the jhana helping us for the search of for the I, or to understand the self? The jhanas themselves do bring some insight, like they're hard to do. If you want to get into the jhana, you can't get into the jhana. You just have to do it. You have to set up the conditions and let it arise. It teaches things about trusting that it will arise without effort on one's part. But the primary function of the jhanas is to bring a concentrated mind so that one can do an insight practice more efficiently afterwards. Doing the insight practice is where we learn about no self, about the I being an illusion. The jhanas themselves do bring some insight, but not nearly as much as a practice geared for insight. So, you concentrate the mind so that you can do the insight practice more efficiently. So that's how the jhanas are used. All of the philosophers, in dealing with the question of the aim of the human life in the life in the universe. Freud said that because we have an answer, we are dealing with the question, what we have. Buddha said, not desire, so we can't deal with what we have. Does Buddha give an alternative answer to the aim of our life in the universe? The Buddha was very much not into speculating about how the world began or the meaning of life or things like that. In fact, if someone were to ask him a question about those sorts of things, he wouldn't answer them. He would answer them with silence. He said, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and its end. So he didn't really say what the meaning of life was, other than to realize our own true nature so that we can put an end to suffering. Can you talk about Ayakema's personal life? How she balanced family life with nunhood, or did she? When she became a nun, she left family life. Her children were grown at that point, and she and her husband got divorced, and she became a nun. So she didn't balance being a nun with family life. I don't think it's possible to do. As for how she balanced them beforehand, I really don't know. Her autobiography has been published in German and will be coming out in English sometime later this year, I would guess in the late fall, early winter period. And perhaps she says something in there about that. Could you please elaborate on the issue of the balance between energy and concentration? What does it feel like when one is high, whilst the other is low, and vice versa? What does it feel like when energy is high and concentration is low? And what does it feel like when concentration is high and energy is low? What it feels like when energy is high and concentration is low is restlessness. You just can't quite seem to get a position that feels good. You know, every way you sit, you know, there's got to be some way to sit a little bit more comfortable. Or the same thing with your mind. Your mind is thinking about this, and you bring it back, and it immediately goes and thinks about that, and maybe you never even follow a single breath the whole time. You have more energy than you have concentration. If you have more concentration than you have energy, what it feels like is going to sleep. Okay? Things get very quiet, and the next thing you know, there's pressure on the front of your head because you've fallen asleep on the floor. Where does such an imbalance lead to? Well, it leads to a very restless meditation if you have too much energy, and it leads to sleeping if you don't have enough. How can we strengthen one in order to get balanced? If you realize that you don't have very strong concentration, you should do a meditation practice that doesn't require strong concentration. For instance, the jhanas require strong concentration. If I'm sleepy and I try to do the jhanas, I go to sleep. When I realize I'm in that state, I often switch to doing the sweeping meditation that we just did. For me, it seems to take less concentration. It's a bit more energetic. There's things to do. It's more active than watching the breath. So if my energy is low, quite frequently I'll do the sweeping meditation. If the energy is too high and there's not much concentration, it's hard to bring the concentration up to the energy. The energy is running so wild that you don't even think about such a thing as concentration. So the trick is to bring the energy down, which is quite difficult. It might be better to take all that energy and do walking meditation rather than sitting meditation, if that's an option at the time. I mean, if you're in the meditation hall and you suddenly realize you have lots of energy and it's the middle of a sitting, well, you're just going to have to deal with it. If you find you have lots of energy, you might go for a very strenuous walk, make yourself a bit more tired. Of course, if you overdo it, then you'll just go to sleep. These are not easy things to balance. It's probably better to recognize what sort of imbalance you have before you start meditating and plan your meditation accordingly. Too much energy? Do walking meditation. Not enough energy, do a meditation that is somewhat energizing, such as the sweeping, if you find the sweeping energizing. You'll have to sort of examine the various forms of practice that you know and see what you find energizing. Is the burden of excess energy just the lack of external stimuli? Sometimes it could be what you ate for lunch. Sometimes it just could be your nature is that you are a restless person and have lots of energy. I don't think that it's possible to pinpoint it for any one person at any, you know, generalization. It's going to be different things at different times. It seems as if it is hard to balance between energy and concentration. At the right time, one seems to be superior to the other at each distinct moment. Generally, what you'll find is that when you start meditating, you'll notice one is stronger than the other. Now, they don't have to be exactly balanced, but they've got to be close, or you sleep or never follow a breath. Okay? And balancing them is not an easy thing to do. Why sit 45 minutes for each session? Why not less or more? If you don't want to sit 45 minutes, it's perfectly okay to sit an hour. If you don't want to sit an hour, you can sit an hour and a half. If you don't want to sit 45 minutes, well, you should hopefully at least sit half an hour. Anything less than a half an hour, you're just beginning to get quiet when you get up. The last 15 minutes of a 45-minute sitting are much more valuable than the first 30 minutes. So if you sit 30 minutes, you've just gotten to the point where you're ready to start really doing some good work. And you get up and you don't ever do the good work. I suggested that you sit for an hour every time you sit. She also suggested you do it twice every single day. Why 45 minutes? It sort of seems that's the most that most people can bear. They just don't really like sitting for an hour, though we just sat for an hour this last time, almost an hour. You can train yourself to sit for an hour. You sit for ever how long you can, and when you feel that, okay, I can bear this, you add 5 minutes. And when you feel you can bear that, you add 5 more minutes, and you work yourself up to an hour, adding approximately 5 minutes every week. Forty-five minutes seems to be just what we manage to fit into our busy lives. I would say an hour is better. 30 minutes is minimum. Is absence of books really necessary? It's better if you don't read while you're on a retreat. It's better if you spend all of your time going deeply inside and seeing what you can see. If you spend your time reading while you're on retreat, you're not spending your time going deep inside. You're passing the time. You're avoiding going deep inside, no matter how wonderful the book is. So is it really necessary? Well, I would say it's really beneficial if you'll take the time to go inside. Is missing the beloved during a retreat part of craving? Yes. If it is so hard you want to leave the retreat to see them, that's real craving. If it's so bad you want to leave the retreat to see them, it might even be insecurity, which is very, very strong craving. Anything on the outside world that you miss is definitely craving. But I do understand about this. In reference to loneliness, our society emphasizes the importance of being couples, the shouldness of being married. There are so many implications to those who are single that it is There is attachment craving for togetherness. Therefore, suffering arises when we are alone, single. How can we cultivate interconnectedness with all beings, therefore seeing ourselves as less alone? How can we work on letting go of attachment to togetherness? Maybe I could have written this question. Our culture very definitely says you should be in a couple. And if you're not, well, there must be something wrong with you. There's a lot of messages that we get from very early childhood, and it's really quite difficult to be happily single in Western culture. It's just not so acceptable. The interconnectedness with other beings is probably best practiced by practicing the loving kindness meditation and by practicing compassion. Compassion is loving kindness in action. So is joy at the joy of others. It's like you have the love, which is a feeling, and then the expression of that feeling is compassion if the one towards whom the love is sent is suffering, and shared joy if the one towards whom the love is sent is joyful. And it's all balanced with equanimity so that one does not get too far out of balance in any direction. Having a wonderful connection with lots of people, I personally find, doesn't alleviate the desire to be in a relationship. Helps. It doesn't feel so lonely, but there's still that desire. The working on letting go of attachment to being part of a couple. The work on everything that we do is a matter of seeing things as clearly as we can, of seeing things as they are. By understanding why we have this desire to be part of a couple, what that's all about, it will help, I hope, in letting go of that attachment. Western psychology has an excellent set of tools for actually looking at this in particular. Theravadan Buddhism doesn't have much at all. It says, become a monk or a nun. No problem. Joy in the joy of sharing, to give up territorialism? I'm not sure. Joy in the joy of others is someone has something and you're happy they have it. The sharing more comes from the compassion aspect. Compassion doesn't have to be alleviating really horrible suffering. It can be just making somebody's life nicer. You have something that might be a benefit to someone else, so you share it with them. I would say that sharing comes more under the heading of compassion than joy with the joy and the joy of others. Now, if somebody has something, then if you are happy that they have it, then that is joy and the joy of others. If you want what they have, that's attachment. And this question is very nice. Nature around here, it can be very special to meditate there. Yes, meditating in nature can be very powerful. The setting in which we meditate is important. There are a number of places in the teachings where the Buddha talks about good places to meditate. And quite often it is mentioned the root of a tree. Obviously going into the forest and sitting under a tree. The Buddha became enlightened sitting under a tree. If you go to the location where the Buddha became enlightened today, it's sort of desert. But at the time of the Buddha, it was much more fertile. There was a lot more rain. It was a jungle area, and apparently it was quite a beautiful spot, this very large tree on the banks of a river. So meditating in a beautiful place in nature can be very nice. It can be distracting, too, if you're not careful. The five basic instructions, I think these are meant the precepts, are phrased as things not to do rather than things to do. To the best of my knowledge, this is not a good way of communication. Doesn't it encourage one to be passive rather than, let's say, joining Greenpeace? Could you please comment on that? Yes, the instructions are, I undertake the training to refrain from killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, wrong speech, and taking intoxicants. However, we should understand that this is the basic, this is the minimum we can get away with, is not killing. Better still to not harm, better still to put it in the positive light, to love all beings. The precepts as they are given is the absolute minimum rules of behavior. However, if you want growth on the spiritual path, you're going to have to do more than the absolute minimum. You're going to have to love everyone, understand about attachments and possessions, and not only not take other people's possessions.